episode, we have Lily Nichols with us. Lily is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with an incredible passion for evidence-based prenatal nutrition. Her work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and critical of outdated dietary guidelines. She is the co-founder of the Women's Health Nutrition Academy and the author of two books, Real Food for Pregnancy and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Lily's best-selling books have helped tens of thousands of mamas and babies, and they're used in university-level maternal nutrition and midwifery courses and have even influenced prenatal nutrition policy internationally. I get to sit down with Lily and we talk about what is real food. Not just the difference between processed food and whole unprocessed food. It's not just that. And of course, we touch on diet and supplements for pregnancy, diet for those women diagnosed with gestational diabetes, and we even manage to fit in best nutrition for recovery post-birth and breastfeeding. This is a wonderful episode full of golden nuggets. I know you'll thoroughly enjoy it. And if you have, please share this on your socials and tag us in your stories. Plus, we are so grateful to all of you who take that extra 5 minutes to write us a review on Apple Podcast. It really helps get this podcast out to a wider audience. And hey, that can only be a good thing, right? So sit back, get a hot water bottle and some warm socks, like me right now. Or if you're down under, like Rachel, grab a fan and open the window to enjoy this incredible episode. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Hi, Lily. Thank you so much for joining us on the Midwives Cauldron. It is an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. And I say us, but listeners, it is just me today. Katie, Rachel is fast asleep, hopefully, because she is on the other side of the world in Australia, and Lily is joining us from the States. So, yep, I wasn't going to ask Rachel to stay up for this one, even though she did send me an email that said, I am so jealous you get to interview Lily. Please say hi with a massive smiley face and a list of questions. So, well, Lily, awesome. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the invite. We'll do another one so she can be on too.
Absolutely. That means that you might have to get up at 3 a.m. So just be careful what you actually say. I'm always fine. I'm in the middle, being in Europe. It's cool. Yeah, Lily, you have written two fantastic books, and the first one called Real Food for Gestational Diabetes and the second Real Food for Pregnancy. How I wanted to start us off today was really asking you, what do you mean by real food?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's about 100 definitions running around out there. My definition of real food might be a little bit more nuanced in that, yes, I'm referring to unprocessed food, but I take the definition of unprocessed food a little bit further, and that I think most people think real food and they think we're talking, you know, whole grains instead of refined grains. And it kind of stops there. I mean, we all kind of have an idea of what junk food is, right? Just like sugary white flour kind of products. And certainly that doesn't fit into the box of real food. But beyond that kind of like industrial food processing, you know, in the past 30, 40 years, our diets have really significantly shifted. And a lot of the foods we see on the grocery shelves, although they might be single ingredient foods, it isn't what our ancestors would have been eating. So some examples I like to give is eggs. So eggs come from a chicken or whatever bird you're getting eggs from, and they have a yolk in there. We don't have egg whites separated, that it comes as a whole for a reason. And the yolk is highly concentrated in a lot of nutrients that are not necessarily found in the white. Likewise for dairy products. Dairy comes from the cow or whatever lactating ruminant with fat. It doesn't come as skim milk or low fat milk. Have any problem with like processing things into yogurt and cheese and whatever. Like we have been finding ways to preserve foods for millennia and I have no problem with that. But when you start taking out the fat, we have a problem. And that's really where a lot of our so-called like single ingredient, but still processed foods are at these days, is they were processed in a way to remove the fat because we, not myself, but you know, government agencies and whatnot decided that fat and cholesterol is bad for us. So those nutrients got a scarlet letter and they went to great lengths to remove fat and cholesterol containing foods from our diet. And so we find the boneless, skinless chicken breasts. That gives us a different nutritional profile than if you're eating the whole animal, nose to tail, still eating the skin. There's valuable nutrients in the skin, some of which we need in higher amounts during pregnancy. So yes, it's all about whole unprocessed foods, but it's also taking that definition just a little bit further. Think about the way in which the products you're buying have been processed, because if it's skim milk, you're not getting the full nutrient profile that you would be if it's whole milk, and yada yada with all the rest of the examples I've already given.
And we have a huge fear of fat. I think it's still, yes. I mean, it totally was instilled in me by my mother, who thought she was doing the best thing, obviously in the 80s and before then. She still has that fear. Like I open her fridge and everything's low fat,
yep.
High in sugar, often like with the low fat yogurts and things like that.
Yep.
And I love hearing that I can eat the skin on chicken and animal fat and, you know, but we hear lots about which fats are good and there's bad fats and there's good fats. And that can be confusing as well, because there's so much information about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's quite overwhelming. And even for somebody who's, you know, been trained in nutrition and is also very like a, you know, has a critical eye when I read research, there's a lot of really bad research out there too, that muddies the waters. And furthermore, you can design studies in ways to get whatever findings you want. So there's a whole lot of that goes on. But when you do really get to a really well-designed, like controlled feeding study where they have like two groups and 100% of their food is provided for, you have full nutritional analysis on all of it, and then look at the outcomes, like the metabolic outcomes, you know, their cholesterol levels, their blood sugar, markers of insulin resistance, changes in weight, etc. You see that a lot of what we have deemed to be supposedly unhealthy doesn't actually play out when you run the clinical studies. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Very interesting. And then I suppose we should really knuckle down and look at pregnancy, because our audience is a fantastic mix. We have midwives, birth workers, healthcare professionals. We also have a huge following of new mums and mums to be. And, you know, there's so much advice out there. And we go to that first antenatal appointment and often we're given the leaflet that says, don't eat this, don't eat that. And it can be really overwhelming and confusing. And then comes into the plan of, you know, should I be taking extra supplements? Like we'll see all the adverts for the prenatal vitamins. Can you talk to that and give us some clarity on where we should be going?
So we'll start with foods to avoid. I actually have like a whole chapter on foods to avoid in Real Food for Pregnancy, half of which is debunking the notion that certain foods are entirely off limits, because the data doesn't necessarily support that the risk benefit is in favor of taking foods out of your diet entirely. So there have been studies that have looked at how strictly women adhere to following foods to avoid lists, especially for things that are listeria risks.
Yep.
So soft cheeses, raw cheese, unheated deli meats, for example. There's several others you could add to that category. And they've actually found that they have poorer nutrient intake than the women who were not as strict about avoiding those wow. listeria risky foods. Furthermore, and although there hasn't been a study specifically in pregnant women showing this, but I know for women who avoid eggs with runny yolks due to fears about salmonella, that's the specific, bacteria of concern for eggs, they have lower intakes of a variety of nutrients, usually because when you take out the eggs, and I'm not saying that's the response that everybody has. You can certainly, follow the advice and cook your eggs until the yolks are fully solid. Some people really like scrambled eggs. There's no problem with doing that. But for the women who really only like the eggs cooked over easy or over medium, where the mm-hmm. yolk is a little bit soft or soft boiled, sometimes they cannot stomach eggs cooked scrambled or hard boiled or whatever. So they take them out, and in place of eating eggs, they're now eating cereal or oatmeal or something else. Yeah, nothing necessarily wrong with that. However, when it displaces the eggs, you get a lower intake of protein almost by default. They're usually not replacing it with a higher protein option. You also get significantly lower intakes of choline, which is one of the major egg yolks are one of the major sources of choline in the diet. About half of our choline intake comes specifically from egg yolks.
Wow, I need to get myself some chickens.
Yeah, absolutely. Backyard chickens are the best.
Oh, it's on the list.
So if you have lower intakes of choline, that has many potential downsides. It's a very important nutrient for placental function, for fetal brain development, for your liver function, for your brain function. And it's involved in methylation in the same way that folate and B6 and B12 is also involved, helps reduce the risk of neural tube defects. Anyways, so you take out eggs and you end up really taking out your primary food source of choline. And then when you look at the relative risk that an egg is contaminated with salmonella, it's anywhere from 1 in 12,000 to 1 in 30,000 eggs. So it's a very, very, very low risk food, actually. I know in some countries you have the option of eggs that have been sort of, I guess, pasteurized or something to remove the, I think that's in the UK. They have the eggs with a special label. That's certainly an option. In the States, that's not an option. But to me, looking at the risk benefit, I'm like, I think the benefit is more in line with getting sufficient amounts of choline. That isn't even touching on the dozens of other nutrients you get in eggs. And taking that, small risk of salmonella. Furthermore, if your eggs are from chickens that are raised on pasture or by organic standards, the rates of salmonella contamination are sevenfold lower than the stats that I've already thrown out there. So if you, again, risk benefit, you get the best quality eggs you possibly can, cook them however you want, and don't worry so much about it. Yeah. And the stats on other foods are pretty similar. I have those laid out in Real Food for Pregnancy. I can't pull them from the top of my head, but the risk of soft cheese or deli meats being contaminated with listeria is really, really, really small. So some of the researchers suggest that these guidelines are just punitive and are not actually based in much scientific rigor.
And we're still giving them out. We're just still giving the same information out, it seems. And there's been not much change, but that happens with many things with research. It takes quite a while to make that change happen. Unfortunately, blimey. So the message here is definitely go and enjoy some runny eggs if you want to.
If that's the way you like your eggs and you're not going to eat them any other way, then yeah. If it brings you too much anxiety to do so, then find ways to cook your eggs until the yolks are solid and enjoy them in other ways, but certainly don't omit the eggs because of this advice.
Well, I'm glad I had two eggs just before our interview as my snack.
So. Oh, I did too.
Oh, snapsies. I like it. That's fab. And so choline, I mean, that's one part of what you were talking about in the eggs. And that's really something as midwives, we don't hone in on. And I don't know where we are at now. Rachel does that. Has been a lecturer for a long time with the student midwives. And in terms of my experience, and I'm going back 20 odd years here, and also throughout my practice, I never did much in the way of nutrition, like a course or a specific time period that we were trained as midwives on nutrition. And I think we only seem to send women to go and see the nutritionist or the dietitian if there is deemed a problem, in quotes. And this is where it gets really complex because, and this is why we all need to go and read your book, really, because it's heavily cited with fantastic resources. And to find out some real truths, because there's a lot of information out there that's old, outdated, and we're just reeling out the same old stuff over and over again.
Yep. And choline, I mean, it's a new one. It's the newest nutrient, at least in the US, to be considered essential. They gave it that title back in 1998. And so if I go back, gosh, like 12 years. I remember I was doing a presentation for a perinatal conference. There was about maybe 300 people there, most of whom were dietitians, diabetes educators, nurse practitioners, doctors, OBGYNs. And I had a slide on choline in my presentation. And I asked the audience, how many of you are familiar with choline? And maybe 10 hands went up in the audience.
Yeah,
it's one that really hasn't made the rounds super widely. I'd say in the past 5-10 years, especially, we've had a lot more research come out. And certainly since I've been writing and speaking on it so much, there's a little more awareness around choline nowadays. And even like the 2020 Dietary Guidelines Committee here, of course, they didn't make that many changes, but they did call out the importance of choline, especially for young children. They warned against a vegan diet specifically because of the choline issue.
Wow.
So there is more awareness, but it is slow. And there are a lot of researchers calling for inclusion of choline in prenatal vitamins because most of the time it's not included. Just much more awareness around it because now we know that it's so important. And even then, the guidelines from 1998 did not really have research on pregnant women to set the recommendations. So those recommendations are extrapolated from data on men, which is actually quite typical.
Yeah.
And now we have studies showing that supplementing with double the current recommended intake of choline, actually slightly more than double, is optimal for both fetal and maternal outcomes, reducing the risk of preeclampsia, enhancing brain development and whatnot. So those guidelines also might be changed over time as we have more data available, because it appears that was definitely an underestimate.
Wow, that's a huge difference. And it really is a, you know, when you listed how important this was, it feels like, why are we not talking about this more? And 1998 is not exactly recent. You know, it's 24 years ago. So
yeah. that's how much time it takes. The average is about 17 years for research to make it into clinical practice. And then it's usually a little bit longer for guidelines to change. So it takes an accumulation of dozens and dozens of studies and sometimes just the passage of time for there to be enough push to change guidelines.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. So are there any other supplements that we should be thinking about during pregnancy or to help with fertility and pregnancy?
Oh, yeah. So to touch on the supplement topic, you know, in an ideal world, we would be getting all of our nutrients from food. However, the vast majority of cases that does not happen. And certainly there is a case to be made for looking at supplements as kind of an insurance policy, not as a replacement, but as an insurance policy to make sure you're getting all the nutrients you need for your health in pregnancy and then optimal fetal development as well. Mm-hmm. So my short list of supplements would be a high quality prenatal vitamin, ideally one that has choline in it, although that's hard to find. They are out there, but it takes getting a supplement that has more than, it's always more than a one a day, probably going to be more than a three a day, because Ooh. Choline is a really bulky nutrient. It takes up a lot of space, minerals as well. So you just can't pack it into a single tablet or capsule. And you want to look on to see how much is in there, because sometimes you have companies put in like pixie dust amounts so you can have choline listed, but it's like 10 milligrams. And the recommended intake, current recommended intake, which is already probably 50% too low, is 450 milligrams per day in pregnancy. So they can put a tiny amount and be like, it has choline, but it's like, not enough to do anything.
Yeah. Always read the label, folks. Always read the label.
Yeah, you got to read the label on those. So I can refer you to chapter 6 of Real Food for Pregnancy, where I kind of outline what to look for in a prenatal prenatal vitamin. A lot of women need additional vitamin D. Some of this is dependent on how much is the prenatal, where they live, where's their baseline vitamin D levels. How much sun exposure do they get? How dark is their skin? The more melanin you have in your skin, the more time you need in the sun to produce the same amount of vitamin D. So that can be particularly challenging to maintain your levels if you are both dark skinned and living far from the equator. So there's many different factors with that, but overall the data is pretty positive in terms of vitamin D supplementation in pregnancy. And we do generally need more than the recommended 600 IUs per day. I guess probably the third thing, and then everything else is pretty optional, would be an omega-3 source specifically for the omega-3 DHA. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, you're looking at animal sources like fish oil, cod liver oil, krill oil. And then there is one vegan option, which is an algae-based DHA supplement. So that's definitely something to consider if you are a person who does not eat at least 12 ounces of fish a week. If you're doing that every week, bar none, you're probably okay on DHA. It's pretty rare that I see women doing that much fish on a regular basis, including myself, actually. I've lived in places where I'm coastal and have access to great fish at a great price. And then I've lived in places where I don't, and I find myself eating less fish if I'm not coastal. And so that's something that, you know, I make the effort to supplement with on the weeks when I'm not getting enough. So the DHA is really vital to fetal brain development. There are
absolutely
very specific and like irreversible times of fetal brain development where DHA is rapidly incorporated into the brain, and also into the eyes that will permanently affect their brain and vision function later in life. So you do want to have, it doesn't have to be a huge amount, but you do want to have a consistent, relatively consistent supply of DHA during pregnancy, during postpartum, if you're nursing, and then throughout the at least the first 2 years of the baby's life, because that's really when you have a lot of that rapid growth happening.
Absolutely. That's great. Thank you. I've got a couple of questions from Rachel, because obviously she can't be here. So she sent me her email saying, please ask some questions. So I'm going to have a look and see what she's asked me. Ah, she's asked this, which I thought was a good one. Why do you warn against a low salt diet in pregnancy? I think that follows on quite well from what we've just been talking about, maybe.
So salt is actually a necessary nutrient for your body. You think about really any other kind of animals, farm animals, you leave out a salt lick for them.
Oh yeah, of course.
Of course.
Forgot that we do that. Yeah.
Yeah. They need some.
Yeah.
So during pregnancy, your blood volume expands and the amount of fluids you have in your system expands. And with that, there's increasing demands for minerals and electrolytes as well. If you think about if you've ever been seriously dehydrated and you go to the hospital to get IV fluids, they don't load you up with distilled water. It's always at least a saline solution. Yeah. You need the salt. It's an essential electrolyte to keep your heart beating and your nerves communicating properly. Mm-hmm. To maintain proper fluid balance, your body will go through pretty extensive work to try to maintain essential electrolytes in your system. And that can mean your body gets really, really dehydrated trying to keep the concentration of electrolytes where they should be. So it goes contrary to what we've all been told, which is that you should limit your salt as much as possible outside of pregnancy for reasons of cardiovascular health. But during pregnancy, they're worried about your blood pressure going up. And ironically, often the opposite happens, where if you decrease the salt too much, the blood pressure goes up in response. Oh, wow. And you increase the salt and the blood pressure goes down. So we've actually known since at least the 1950s that you can, back then they called preeclampsia toxemia, they could reverse toxemia with the inclusion of 4 heaping teaspoonfuls of salt per day.
Wow. Do you think that's still
crazy?
It's kind of crazy. I wonder whether does that still, I'm just thinking about the diets in the 50s compared to the diets now, which is much more processed food in, say, the average Western diet, whereas in the 50s, a lot more was being home cooked. I wonder whether that makes a difference. And I wonder whether that fear also comes from, you know, if we're having more packaged food, more processed kind of bread that isn't with sort of ancient grains, if that's what people are eating, or does that make a difference?
And if your diet is heavily processed foods, you're probably eating more salt and you wouldn't necessarily need to go out of your way to get more sodium in. However, at the same time, a lot of your processed foods are really high in refined grains and sugars and fructose, and those things raise your blood pressure. So it's not the salt necessarily. Sometimes it's the refined grains and sugars that are having that effect. Wow. So I definitely don't think, eating more processed foods because it has a lot of salt is a good path.
That's the takeaway from Lily being here today. No, definitely not.
Yeah, right. I find that on the flip side, when people adopt more of a home cooked meals approach, because we haven't all grown up cooking a whole lot, people don't add enough salt when they cook at home. So when I go to people's houses, nobody's listening who I've been to their house, the food is really bland because they don't add enough salt. So you do need to cook with, enough. I usually do anywhere between a half and a teaspoon of salt per pound of raw ingredients, whether it's raw meat or raw vegetables. It depends on what it is. But generally speaking, that's like a good ratio to get a sufficient amount of salt. It makes all the bitter vegetables not taste bitter anymore. It makes everything taste good. It brings out the flavors. And it also tends to, I think, help your appetite, because there is some discussion that perhaps we have like a built-in, kind of like animals, a built-in like salt appetite. And if we don't hit that at our meals, then we're going to be craving other salty foods to fill in the gaps. And for myself, I certainly anecdotally think that that's the case. But during pregnancy, think about how many cravings are for salty foods.
Yeah.
We joke about like the pickles and the olives and the French fries and the chips. And yeah. I noticed for myself, like a lot of these cravings were really salt driven. I needed more salt. So, and then if you decrease your salt too much, it can lead to other problems because we need sodium for the baby to develop properly. You need it for proper thyroid function and brain function, for cardiovascular function, maintaining fluid balance. So if you're having a situation of like low amniotic fluid, the response is not to restrict salt. I would actually increase the salt because your body is probably preferentially trying to excrete water to maintain the electrolyte balance. And if you get in more salt, your body can better balance that out for you and you won't have low amniotic fluid anymore. So yeah, the research really does not support a salt restricted diet in pregnancy. I outline this much more eloquently in the chapter 7 of Real Food for Pregnancy compared to what I can just pull from the top of my head. But it's definitely not in support of restricting salt.
That's awesome. Don't worry. Rachel's always on this podcast. She has her own book and we refer to it and other things, and we have to stop and start and read. It's part of, we can't remember everything. So
oh, yeah.
I think that's a fantastic explanation and has really, yeah, the stuff about the a low amniotic fluid as well. That's really fascinating, interesting stuff. And it's just making my brain go, oh, great. And I'm glad I put, you know, people always say to me, put too much salt but on my food. But I am, I cook and I don't use processed foods. And I'm like, right. This is what my body feels like it needs. And then it tastes great. Like,
yeah, when you're cooking from scratch, you need a surprising amount of salt. If you ever watch cooking shows, I mean, I grew up watching cooking shows.
Me too.
That was like my favorite pastime. And so you watch them and you're like, dang, they have a heavy hand with the salt. And you go to a restaurant, you don't think about it, but the reason the food tastes really good is they used enough salt and fat to cook the food.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, that's definitely something to keep in mind.
Love it. That's brilliant. Well, I think there is a burning question which we need to, or a topic which we must consider, and the reason why, one of the reasons why we brought you on. And I think we need to touch base with what's going on with gestational diabetes and how carbohydrates influence blood glucose levels and how this all plays together into gestational diabetes.
Well, gestational diabetes is elevated blood sugar during pregnancy at its simplest definition. Whether that was a pre-existing blood sugar issue that we identified during pregnancy or something that has occurred as a response to the physiological adaptations of pregnancy, we don't know. Either one, when your blood sugar is high in pregnancy, we call it gestational diabetes. Another definition of gestational diabetes is carbohydrate intolerance of pregnancy, which I think is probably one of the most fitting definitions because it essentially is saying your body is unable to tolerate large amounts of carbohydrates eaten in one sitting without experiencing high blood sugar. And that points to exactly the intervention that is the most effective for managing gestational diabetes, which is matching your carbohydrate intake to an amount that your body can tolerate without having high blood sugar. Mm. It's not rocket science, but it's highly controversial in the dietetics, nutrition, obstetrics space, mm-hmm. which I am certainly no stranger to.
No, you're
not. And
that's
really the whole reason that I had to write my book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, back in 2015, was because what I was seeing is the guidelines were too high in carbohydrates. And so all of these women who were, quote, failing diet therapy mm-hmm. were not failing diet therapy. The diet was failing them. It was too high in carbs for their physiology. And you simply, you know, there's more to it than just reducing the carbs, but part of it is you reduce the carbs, replace them with more nutrient dense foods. You get the nutrients that help with, you know, insulin, reducing insulin resistance and like blood sugar management, but also you're just not stressing out the pancreas so much, requiring it to pump out so much insulin because your blood sugar is so high consistently, meal after meal, snack after snack, day after day. So the simple answer is, yeah, our guidelines are way too high in carbohydrates to properly manage gestational diabetes. And not only from my own clinical experience, but also from the research, we have seen, you know, a lower glycemic index diet. So carbs that don't spike your blood sugar quite as much, as well as a lower carb diet, reduces blood sugar spikes by about 50%. It also reduces the chances that a woman will require insulin or medication therapy by about 50%. Wow. So those numbers are straight from the literature, and they're absolutely related. If you don't spike your blood sugar as much, you don't need as much insulin, either what your body's producing or what you might need to take supplementally.
Yet there seems to be this kind of fear or this indoctrination with all of us from the food pyramid to now the plate pyramid almost, of it's whole grains, it's grains, it's carbs are your main diet. And I find this topic is really difficult because there is this kind of mantra of, you know, that's what we need. That's right. Really important. And how do we make this change? How do we open the eyes of both practitioners and women who are pregnant, who are going through this, to see this?
Well, I think it starts with just presenting the data. So my approach has always been, you know, even if our guidelines are built on like shaky ground in terms of how much evidence supports them, you almost have to come at it with like an avalanche of evidence for them to change, which is really frustrating because they're essentially, it's pulled out of thin air, honestly, like how they came up with the minimum amount of carbohydrates you need for pregnancy. And in addition, the justification for not going low carb being you don't want to go into ketosis is also not founded.
Right.
And I outline that really extensively in the last chapter of Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. I was actually speaking at a diabetes educators conference last spring, 2021, and came across a study published in 2021 that essentially was looking at whether our recommendations for carbs, which almost exclusively are based on the avoidance of ketosis, are warranted or not. Are they evidence-based or not? And it was so funny because I read through this paper and I was like, this is exactly all of the points that I made in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. I guarantee you it made a bigger splash to do that in book form than publishing in an academic journal that like, what, 100, 200 people might read.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it was also really, what's the word I want to say? Not gratifying, but like, yeah, I told you so. You know? Like years ago, 6 years ago, I was, you know, actually, if you go back to when the book was written 7 years ago, I was already writing about this, but essentially they found that there was no, rational or scientific basis for the counseling against low carb diets, especially on the basis of avoidance of ketones. I've certainly shown via running nutritional analyses on different meal plans that you can get plenty of your micronutrient needs met. You meet all your micronutrient needs and do it actually better, have a more nutrient dense diet when your diet is lower in carbohydrates, because a lot of your carbohydrate rich foods are not the most nutrient dense. So when you look at the nutrients that are of most concern for perinatal health, and also which nutrients tend to be deficient or underconsumed among women of childbearing age, those are almost exclusively not found in your carbohydrate rich foods. Your best sources are usually your protein and fat rich foods, like your animal products, like meat, dairy, eggs, seafood, nuts, seeds, legumes, yeah. some in vegetables, of course. And it's not saying that all carbs are bad or it's a useless part of the diet. All of my meal plans contain carbs, and much to the chagrin of the low carb community, I actually include more carbs than most of the keto community would like me to include in my meal plans. It's just that we don't need a diet that's based on grain products. That does not help us meet those micronutrient goals whatsoever. And furthermore, the guidelines tell us that we can have half our grains whole. So in other words, half our grains as refined grains, which I think the justification is that refined grains are fortified in most countries with things like folic acid and iron, a couple other B vitamins. That's all fine and good, but you're still not getting great nutrition from refined grains compared to if those were all whole grains, or if we focused more of our carb intake on lower glycemic sources, like, you know, our winter squash and our, you know, low sugar fruits and our non-starchy vegetables and our nuts and seeds and whatnot. Like, that would give us a much better micronutrient intake with significantly lower blood sugar spikes across the board. So it's hard to reconcile all of this, and I've kind of given up on reconciling it, honestly. Like, guidelines are going to do what they're going to do, whether it works or doesn't work. And so my approach is really to get that information into the hands of women themselves and their providers. If you want to, you know, put this into practice and see the difference in your blood sugar levels, you can make the choice to do that. I don't expect the guidelines to be shifting, at least in the U.S., anytime soon. They actually did shift in the Czech Republic as of 2016. They revised their gestational diabetes guidelines in line with what I present in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Somehow my book got in the hands of one of their top diabetologists. And they've since, what they did is they changed their carbohydrate guidelines from a minimum intake of 200 grams to a maximum intake of 200 grams.
Wow.
So just reversed it essentially and really started promoting more protein-rich foods, more fruits and vegetables. And they've seen a significant reduction in the rates of requiring insulin or medication, significant reduction in adverse birth outcomes, typically attributed to gestational diabetes. So they're seeing like much better outcomes, which is, you know, exactly what I saw in practice too. And is exactly what you see in the literature as well, when you help reduce those blood sugar spikes. And, you know, that can't always be done without the help of insulin and medication, but we certainly can reduce the rates of requiring those things, which ultimately is going to reduce the rates of, you know, adverse birth outcomes, going to reduce the rates of interventions at birth, whether warranted or not. We all know that women with gestational diabetes are often recommended. Things like early induction, which is actually not evidence-based, all sorts of things. You know it all because you're in the midwifery world. So if we could, like, my way of getting around this is like, okay, we're probably not going to change those guidelines, but if your blood sugar is so well managed, they probably won't recommend those things quite as often to you, or you'll have more like ammo to fight back against it if you want to fight for your birth center birth or home birth or not being induced at 39 weeks or whatever it is.
Oh, brilliant. So well said. Totally agree, Lily. Would you say there was any option or there was any need that women should be continuously monitoring their blood glucose?
To use a continuous glucose monitor, a CGM? I mean, I personally love the use of CGM because it gives you much, much more information. You have like 240 plus readings over the course of a day versus if you're just doing finger sticks, you have typically four, maybe six. Sometimes they'll recommend before and after each meal, but most of the guidelines here anyways are fasting blood sugar. So first thing in the morning before you've eaten anything, and then after each meal. So four times a day, you could add before each meal if you wanted to. Even still, we're really kind of guesstimating when is your blood sugar going to spike, and are we catching the spike with that post-meal prick? We don't really know. You also don't know with that single reading whether your blood sugar is trending up or if you're on the downslope. You don't really know what's happening. What's happening between meals? What's happening overnight? So is your blood sugar staying high all night long? Is it dipping down and rebounding high? Is it staying even keeled the whole night? That information you don't have from a finger prick. I will say that, so I've worn CGM a number of times, both pregnant and not pregnant. And I will say that some people can get like a little bit obsessive about the data, like trying to avoid any spike whatsoever. Like, it's okay for your blood sugar to rise a little bit about after eating. That's normal. Don't have to go full on keto. So there is that caveat that sometimes it makes people a little neurotic about it. And for people who have like a history of disordered eating, I could see that potentially being problematic. But from a general sense, I think if we were able to give a CGM sensor several times during the pregnancy, so they typically last about 2 weeks, and then between then do finger sticks, that would probably be the best of both worlds. So you could use those like 2 week time periods to get an idea of like how your blood sugar responds to different foods, how quickly you spike, how quickly you drop, how low you drop, see how well you can like flatten those glucose curves, and then continue implementing that same thing when you're doing your finger sticks in between, right? I think that would probably be the best of both worlds because CGM isn't always accessible to everyone. Sometimes it's more expensive. You can lead to the whole neurotic situation that I outlined. I do have a blog post on CGM on my site called CGM Experiment if people want to look up that article. I actually did that. I wasn't pregnant at the time, but I tested out just eating my normal diet and then did a couple experiments in there, including having the recommended oatmeal, fruit, and milk for breakfast, and showed the response to that, which is pretty horrific for somebody who has really well-managed blood sugar on a day-to-day basis. To drive home our point that we've been making for most of this episode on blood sugar balance. But yeah, I think it's a very useful tool, and I hope that it's expanded more. In the States, it's pretty hard to get a hold of CGM. There are a couple options, but for the most part, you have to get a prescription through your healthcare provider, and a lot of them are resistant to it.
The oatmeal and milk thing. Yes, absolutely. Like, yep. That was my childhood diet. I have not eaten like that for a very long time, and recently had to do a trial diet that put me back on sort of a millet, because I don't do gluten, and a millet and rice milk. So it was like all of the carbs, millet and rice milk, and had blueberries. And the crashes were unbelievable, like the hypos that I was feeling, like couldn't slurred speech, like just total shakes, everything. And I was like, this is just not for me. I don't feel balanced at all. And so, and it was like, wow, God.
Absolutely. Yeah, same. Like you, I've been eating this way for a long time, at least decade and a half now. And every once in a while, you know, it's fine to test things out. So I like the taste of oatmeal, actually. Some people don't like it, but that was my go-to breakfast for years and years. And I did it all the right ways. I did the steel-cut oats that were soaked overnight and then cooked in the morning. Not a lot of sugar, just, you know, a little bit of fresh fruit and cinnamon, and then put in like all the protein stuff, mix in the almond butter, you know, add the collagen powder,
add the chia seeds.
I mean, really doing all the things to balance it out. I'm sure it reduced the spike a little bit. But and at that time I wasn't checking my blood sugar, but just judge based on my symptoms, I would always be starving within an hour and a half or 2 hours later, which is a sign of a crash, really. And nowadays, doing my breakfasts of, you know, eggs, maybe some bacon in there, veggies. I do incorporate carbs. I make homemade sourdough, or sometimes I'll have sweet potatoes or some fruit in there. But because it's paired with so much protein and fat, I cook all of it in like butter or lard or something. There's no crash. There's no crash. I can keep going for hours and hours and hours and be fine. And by the time it's lunchtime, it's like, well, I guess I'm kind of hungry. But there's no insane, like, your stomach is just going to, like, or your brain is not going to function anymore. No, those things no longer exist. And that's coming from somebody who dealt with reactive hypoglycemia for a really, really long time. It's really about getting in sufficient amounts of protein and fat, and not doing the whole naked carbs or highly concentrated sources of carbs, and everything's fine. It turns out I'm not a crazy person. It's just what physiologically happens when you eat way too many carbs in one sitting for your physiology, you know. And different people, some people seem to tolerate oats fine. I'm not saying that it's bad for everybody. That's where a CGM can be helpful, because you can actually see, you know, I was able to see like oatmeal and rice are particularly bad for my blood sugar, but my sourdough bread is A-okay. Potatoes eaten in the context of a full meal, totally fine. For the most part, fruit, as long as it's paired appropriately with, you know, some protein and fat, seems to be fine. But oatmeal and rice are like really not great for my blood sugar. Does it mean I never have them anymore? No, but when I do, the portion is pretty small, and it's, you know, in context of other foods, because I know it doesn't make me feel well. So it just, in other words, it becomes like an empowering choice rather than a, I need to avoid this thing forever and ever or else kind of a choice.
And I think that's really important, because it can be really overwhelming if you've eaten a diet all your life and then all of a sudden you're diagnosed with gestational diabetes and you come across your work, because you might not find it elsewhere, and you think, how am I going to do this? Like, how am I going to change my lifestyle? And I think you saying it's looking at the food as an empowerment of, I'm going to feel better. And within a few days, probably within a day, you generally will. That's the motivation to keep going, because it's not always as easy as just opening something that's ready made. You do have to work. And, you know, when you're preparing food like this, it does take time.
Mm-hmm. It does. But I will also say the most disempowering thing is to be given a meal plan from your hospital or well-meaning dietitian, follow it to a T, feel like you're starving, because after each meal, you're going to have the shakes from being super, super hungry and like reactive hypoglycemia. I mean, a lot of people end up feeling like they're starving and then still have high blood sugar.
It's,
and then what
so
is your
distressing?
It's really disempowering. So the most empowering thing is to know that you have options, you know, that it's controllable, it's manageable. For better or for worse, diabetes is a really significant part of our, you know, growing health issues as a culture. So just as we see the rates of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes on the rise, you see gestational diabetes on the rise as well. It's the same pathophysiology, the same. Yeah, there's a little bit thrown in there with pregnancy, but for the most part, this is an underlying insulin resistance issue. And it's manageable, not always 100% with diet. You know, sometimes you do need the help of insulin and medication, but to know that you can reduce those blood sugar spikes to the point that you might not need the help of medication, or if you do need it, you won't need as high of a dose, because that comes with its own, I don't want to call them side effects, but like if you're eating a high carb diet that necessitates high dose insulin to lower those spikes, you're going to be puffy, inflamed, gain a whole lot of weight, retain a lot of fluids. It has its own potential issues. Our whole goal is not only to manage the blood sugar, but also to like keep your insulin at a good place as well. So if you're able to do that, you know, a little better with, you know, food and lifestyle, it's empowering. And I do hear from a lot of people that it's like, you know what, it was kind of a blessing in disguise, or there was a silver lining to getting this diagnosis, because I've never been so motivated in my life to figure out like how to eat well and to be able to see it firsthand with the blood sugar readings. And of course you have that like sort of crushing responsibility of knowing that this could impact your baby. So like there is never a more motivated client than somebody who's pregnant, really.
Yeah.
That then they can carry that forward into postpartum, because you realize, oh, it's not just about keeping the blood sugar at a level that I'm not going to get yelled at by my doctor or something, you know, that's part of it.
No, it's actually how I feel.
Yeah. And I hate that it has to, sometimes you have providers that rely on like fear tactics and yelling, and like, it shouldn't get to that, but you know, it sometimes does, unfortunately. But it's not so much about that as it is about feeling well. So maybe they'll also realize, hey, you know what, when my blood sugar comes out in this range, I also have more energy. I'm also more satisfied for a longer period of time. You know what, my cravings for XYZ food have gone down a lot. Mm-hmm. And look, like my last pregnancy, I gained 60 pounds. In this pregnancy, I've gained like 28. What gives? You know, I don't feel like I'm on a diet. This just sort of happened this way. And my pregnancy is so much easier than my prior ones. And oftentimes recovery is easier as well.
Yeah.
And then you can carry those same lifestyle habits forward into postpartum. Of course, it's going to look different, and you get like a free pass during the first month or so postpartum when everything is crazy. Don't feel like you need to be on like, you shouldn't be on a restrictive diet. If anything, you need to eat a lot more food.
Absolutely.
However, when things kind of settle down with the newborn fog, and you're sort of a little more clear-headed, these are the same things that you can return to lifelong for having good energy levels, stable blood sugar levels, maintaining your weight easily. Those are all things that carry forward long-term. And we do know, you know, yeah, I know you've talked previously in other episodes about some of the issues with gestational diabetes, and how it's overdiagnosed and whatnot. At the same time, we do know that gestational diabetes is the number one predictive risk factor for the development of type 2 diabetes in women later in life. So I sort of refer to it as like the warning light going on in your car.
Mm.
Like, okay, you don't need to take your car in right away. It's not going to break down in the road right now, but like in the next couple of weeks, you probably should see a mechanic. You know, this is a sign that there's something going on with blood sugar and insulin regulation. But also you have time to work on it. So we can really, you know, some of the studies show that conversion to type 2 diabetes later in life is anywhere from like 30 to 70% when you've had a GD pregnancy. So it is something where, yeah, you want to keep an eye on this long-term. It's not as like emergent as like dealing with high blood sugar during pregnancy, but it's something to have in the back of your mind, you know, long-term, and do this for the sake of feeling good and your well-being. I don't want you to have to prick your finger for the rest of your life or be on metformin or insulin forever and ever. And it's very likely that you don't have to be.
Fantastic. Okay. So for me, I'm a lactation consultant. I'm a midwife as well, but obviously my focus is often with the breastfeeding mom, and those calorie requirements, as you touched on, they really go up around about 500 calories a day. And I just wondered if there was any specific important factors we should be looking at really for that initial postpartum period or in the long term, and not just breastfeeding, because it's also the recovery, you know, the type of birth that we've had, and if our diet can affect how we recover and how we get into that new transition phase of being a mother.
Well, it's huge and highly overlooked how much nutrition can impact not only recovery, but also breastfeeding as well. And arguably kind of controversial on the breastfeeding front, beyond just saying you need more food and you need more calories. A lot of times people don't want to take it any further. As far as the recovery, this applies to anyone, whether you choose to breastfeed long-term or not. Your body has just done like the most amazing feat on the planet, which is to create a new life from scratch that requires a lot of nutrients. And yes, we come into pregnancy with nutrient stores and we eat hopefully well, maybe in the latter half of pregnancy, if you didn't get blindsided too badly with food aversions and nausea. But still, you're going to leave pregnancy probably in your most nutrient depleted state of any other time in your life. So it is a time of repletion. And there are a lot of really all cultures around the world that are still in touch with their roots. So anything other than the West, have specific postpartum practices, often involving food, as well as other habits and having help around and whatnot to keep you well nourished and kind of refill those nutrient coffers and help you recover well. And there's a lot of overlap with those, which is really, really interesting. And so some of the big ones are foods that are really easy to digest and warming, like soups and broths, and well-cooked vegetables, well-cooked meats, organ meats, eggs, that also happen to be high protein, that also happen to be high in a lot of nutrients that help with red blood cell production, because inevitably you lose some blood during birth, some more than others. So you need your iron, your copper, your B12, your vitamin A, your folate, among many other nutrients to build new red blood cells, new blood. You need a lot of different nutrients to help your tissues recover, not only from what you've experienced just with everything growing and stretching exponentially during pregnancy, but also the stretching, potential tearing, or surgical incision of birth. And then things will continue to stretch as your milk comes in, your breasts will engorge quite a bit, like remarkably large amounts, I could say.
I always say Dolly Parton comes to town.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it looks like you have implants. It's really such a bizarre.
You wake up in the morning and go, oh my God, that's what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. After having nursed two kids. Yeah, it's very interesting. So all of that requires quite a bit of protein, especially, and a lot of amino acids that our body uses to build and repair collagen. That's really what we need for our skin, our uterus, our connective tissues, pelvic floor. So you see a lot of collagen-rich foods come up in those postpartum practices, like bone broth, eating sort of nose to tail, as we've been talking about. So including the skin, the organ meats, a lot of these things you see come up in these postpartum practices. And unfortunately for the West, since most of us do not have the help part of it already built in, this ends up kind of falling on your shoulders, and you're not going to be cooking in early postpartum, or really you shouldn't be doing a lot of cooking in early postpartum. I'm just going to say you're not going to be up for it physically. It should fall on somebody else. And so if it's not going to fall on somebody else, you have to do the prep work ahead of time to be nourished postpartum. And I can't tell you how, well, first of all, I experienced it myself firsthand, not thinking anything about postpartum recovery. Everything is planning for the birth, right? So you don't think anything about postpartum recovery.
Yeah.
You know, I had my baby at 39 and one. I thought I would go to 41 weeks because everyone says with your first, you're going to go late. And so all my meal plan prep I was going to do in those last 2 weeks that I thought I had. No.
Out the window.
Had a handful of things prepped. So postpartum, I'm like asking my husband to make the my hidden liver meatloaf recipe because my body was so deeply craving red meat and organ meats. Oh my God, I've never eaten so much meatloaf in my life. Second time around, this you're is on after it. I've written Real Food for Pregnancy, right? Because I started writing that book when I was about 10 months postpartum. Wow. I did all the prep. I started prepping food and putting in the freezer starting at 20 weeks. So I would have each week, I'd try to get one thing in the freezer. So I'd have something to pull from to eat during that postpartum time. Invited my mom to stay with us for a month, invited all the help, you know. So we learn things through experience. And when we've lost these traditions, and our families don't even have these traditions. You know, my mom was like, are you sure you want me to stay for a whole month? Yes, please. I would love for you to stay for a month.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, because she didn't get that. That wasn't a cultural tradition anymore. And we need to bring these things back because it makes postpartum so much easier when you have some help. And in lieu of help, you have prepping meals ahead of time, you have meal delivery services, you have postpartum doulas, you have asking friends and family to do a meal train. You know, there are ways around it, but it often takes planning because you might not be in the brain space to know what to ask for, what to outsource. You're just in recovery newborn land. I know I didn't touch on breastfeeding, but briefly on the breastfeeding part, it does require a lot more nutrients. So not just the extra calories. And this generally applies to about the first 6 months or the period of exclusive breastfeeding when really your energy and nutrient needs are so much higher. There's no guidelines for after that, by the way. So we're flying blind for after that. But for that period of exclusive breastfeeding, you do need more food and more nutrient dense foods. So the same things you've been doing during pregnancy, the same things that I highlight in my book and have highlighted in this talk, those are the same things you want to eat during postpartum, just in higher amounts. And there is actually a very interesting study that came out, I'm trying to remember what year it was, looking at protein requirements for breastfeeding women. They measured this at 3 to 6 months postpartum. So this isn't even early postpartum. Mm. So most of the major recoveries and tissue healing has already taken place.
Yep.
Anyways, they found that protein requirements are 1.7 to 1.9 grams per kilogram, which is like 80 to 100% more than what the guidelines are at. And this is 3 to 6 months postpartum. Wow. So we don't have a study yet showing us what the protein requirements are in early postpartum. I guarantee you they're higher than that because it's going to be at the level of somebody recovering from like a major surgery or something.
Yeah.
Your body's gone through 9 months of growing a human. Now, depending on how the birth goes down, you could have a really, really significant nutrient demand for recovery. Like if you had a C-section or especially a C-section after a long, exhausting labor or a really bad tear or episiotomy or something, you're going to require a lot more nutrients. So we don't know how high that is for the early time. I'm guessing it's higher. So all of your protein-rich foods you need more of. You need more vitamin A, you need more iron, you need more zinc, you need more folate, you need more, I mean, you name it, you probably need more of it postpartum. So eat as many of the good foods as you possibly can. Keep yourself as nourished as you can. Try to get help to bring you that food and heat it up for you. Drink a lot of fluids. Don't skimp on the salt and electrolytes. You don't have to make it complicated, but we do need to have a greater emphasis on nourishing ourselves postpartum. The work is not yet done. We think it's all done once baby is here, and you continue to need that nourishment at even higher amounts than during pregnancy.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm so glad you were able to give us those little golden nuggets at the end. I could just sneak in about the postpartum, and I'm sure we could do a whole episode just on postpartum.
Oh, yeah.
On each of the topics that we've talked on. But you have some incredible resources that are available for pregnant women and also for healthcare professionals and anybody who has an interest. You have the Women's Health Nutrition Academy, and you run that with your colleague. I'm hoping I pronounce her name right. Isla Barmer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. It was the double M that put me off. And please, will you tell our audience before I let you go today, even though I'd love to keep you on for far longer, what's available and what they can find on your website. And we will, of course, post all the links in the show notes to all of Lily's offerings and her fantastic website where you can find her books as well.
Yes, thank you. So the Women's Health Nutrition Academy is over at whnacademy.com. And that is really a resource that my colleague Ayla and I put together to fill in this gap of continuing education on women's health topics. We're both dietitians by training, both specialize in women's health. And most of what we've learned on our own. There's no single place that you can go to learn these things. Or sometimes you go to continuing education and it's like really not very detailed and kind of disappointing. Or sometimes you feel like you might know more than the speaker. So we wanted to put in the work to do really detailed, evidence-based webinars on a variety of women's health topics. I certainly tend to take on the pregnancy angle and postpartum, breastfeeding a bit more. So related to today, gosh, I have one on gestational diabetes. And these are geared towards practitioners, by the way. So, you know, we can't police who joins or not. Yeah. We do have a lot of women themselves who are just like really interested and want to learn all the nitty gritty details, but we come at it from the understanding that you have a background in these things, because sometimes we are getting into, you know, the biochemistry of folate metabolism and stuff, which isn't always of interest to the general public. But I do have one on gestational diabetes. I have one on vitamin D in pregnancy. I have one on postpartum recovery and nutrient repletion. That one is especially popular among like everyone. We have a lot of women just take that one because they want to go beyond the postpartum chapter in Real Food for Pregnancy. I have one on nutrition and breastfeeding, specifically focused on nutrient transfer into breast milk. And so that's a highly, highly controversial topic that we didn't touch on today.
I know. But
suffice to say, the quality of your diet can impact levels of certain micronutrients in breast milk. And there's a lot of data on that. So I've heard from a lot of IBCLCs who have taken it and appreciated it because that was not an angle covered in their training necessarily.
Definitely isn't. Yeah, it's really not a big push, you know, at all.
I had a really wonderful IBCLC after my first was born, and it always stuck with me, you know, where she was like, yeah, what you eat doesn't impact the breast milk. It's always good. And I was like, that just doesn't make sense to me. So
of all the people to say to.
Yeah. And I, you know, it comes from a loving place. They don't want anybody to feel discouraged that breastfeeding requires that you eat like a special diet or something like that.
The whole point is supporting you, whatever you do, so that you feel confident to keep breastfeeding, because that's blooming marvelous anyway.
And that's really important. But there's more nuance to it, right? It's like, yeah, of course you can eat a McDonald's meal and your milk is still good. Don't quit breastfeeding because you had McDonald's, right?
Absolutely.
But over time, eating a McDonald's diet produces a different nutrient profile in your milk than eating more of like a real food made from scratch diet. It just does. So it's funny that it's controversial. I understand why it is. In addition to WHNA webinars, you can find lots of resources on my website, which is lilynicholsrdn.com. So I have, you know, 250 plus blog articles up there. In recent years, my articles have been much more detailed and fully cited on some controversial topics, you know, like folate versus folic acid, you know, articles on choline, protein requirements in pregnancy. Just use the search function and have at it. You can find my books there as well. You can find my gestational diabetes course, this one specifically for moms themselves. So you need to go beyond like the book, or you want my input specifically on what you can do to help lower your fasting blood sugar, because maybe your clinician told you there's nothing you can do, or it's only a nighttime snack. And if that doesn't work, you're like on the train to insulin. That course is really, really helpful if you're in that scenario. And we do have a private Facebook group where I interact directly during weekly office hours. So yeah, there's more, but there's lots up there. There's lots of freebies. You can get the first chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy for free. I really just try to make as many of my resources available for free or low cost as possible. So there's, you know, an array of angles that you can get the information from like free blog posts to inexpensive webinar to a book to, you know, course. I have you covered.
You certainly do. And from me and also from Rachel, thank you for the work that you've done. Like, it's just fantastic in supporting health professionals like us and also the people that are listening to this podcast. So I just am so grateful for you being with us today. You have given us a snapshot into something which can often be not seen as important, and yet it goes hand in hand with this whole continuum from falling pregnant to into the postpartum period. And it really is something for us to all look further into. So I highly recommend you go and seek out Lily's website and all the details she said today. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And thank you for your work as well.
Thanks. Oh my goodness, what an amazing and insightful episode with Lily. So many nuggets. Happy eating, peeps. Once again, and as always, please stop what you're doing and don't go anywhere, as I need you to get into Apple and tell them what you think of this podcast. Yes, you. If you don't, who will? I can only scream so loudly to get these messages heard, but I need your help. This is why I started this podcast, so I could help these messages of empowerment, rebellion, and passion from some incredibly great minds get out to not just those people who read journals or articles, blogs or books, but also the wider audience who also deserve to have access to this information. Let's make this change together in this bubbling cauldron of ours. And if you would like to donate to support the podcast further, please click on the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or over on our Instagram at The Midwives Cauldron, where for as little as the price of a bunch of daffodils, or perhaps you choose the fancy red roses bouquet today, you can help us provide this content to more and more people who need it. We are so thrilled to have you with us, and we'll see you next time. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals, has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.